Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Committee on Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, I just wanted to, Chair Fisher, did you want to move the approval for minutes for March 7th?
Yes, please. Chair Noor, I'd like to move the approval of the minutes from March 7th, 2023.
Chair Fisher moves the approval for minutes for March 7th, 2023. Discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, see none. The minutes for March 7, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have got a couple of bills today. There's a little bit of a switch. We will start with House File 2329. Chair Hassan, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce the bill. I'll first move your bill, that House File 2329, to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm presenting today House File 2329, a very important bill that impacts every Minnesotan in one way or another. As you will hear in a few minutes, we're losing family and friends every day to opioid addiction. Thanks to some members of this committee and my testifiers, we have made some significant headway in recent years, but the challenge and the need for response is much greater. Nearly 1,500 Minnesotans lost their life to drugs last year, a number that's more than doubled since 2018. Fentanyl and synthetic opioid are much more potent than other narcotics, and 60% overdose increase. The 881 fentanyl deaths represent more than a fourfold increase since 2018. As a member of Minnesota's Somali American community, I have seen firsthand the devastating impact of opioid epidemic in our community. I also represent a District 62A, 62B, I'm still saying 62A, that changed, 62B, which also has Little Earth and has a significant, Native community, and that also had an opioid epidemic in the last few years has devastated that community as well as the Black community in South Minneapolis. House File 2329 aims to increase awareness and protection to general communities around the state and intentionally focuses on the East African population, providing access to life-saving tools like Narcan and Naloxone. This proposed funding, directed by the Steve Rumler Hope Network, will empower local partners and organizations statewide to build a collaborative approach to tackle the opioid crisis through community engagement. This bill addresses the stigma. Sorry, my computer froze. This bill addresses the stigma surrounding opioid addiction and mental health in many communities, which has prevented many from seeking the help they need by providing a wraparound services and campaign targeting public and private sectors where preventive measures are needed. We can help those affected by opioid addiction and make positive impact. There is a handout which provides much more detail about the need and the key organizations involved with this proposal. More importantly, Mr. Chair, I have three testifiers, actually, and the first testifier is Alicia House from Steve Rumler Hope Network.
Ms. House, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to Representative Hassan for her leadership in bringing this bill forward. My name is Alicia House, and I'm the Executive Director of the Steve Rumler Hope Network.
Should I just begin?
Yeah. Okay. I have a firm belief that everyone in this room and via video has a personal connection to this bill in one form or another. In 2021, 3 Minnesotans per day lost their lives to an opioid overdose. These are our friends, loved ones, colleagues, students, neighbors, and constituents. There is no doubt that a large spectrum of vital services in combating this crisis are needed. Prevention is the door to all of these multiple pathways, because we know dead people do not recover. Fentanyl has brought this crisis to another level by expanding fatal overdose risk beyond just those who use opioids. Fentanyl is being laced into all illicit substances and pressed into counterfeit prescription pills. Given the dangers of unintentional exposure coupled with the lack of awareness and education on topics like overdose prevention and response, lives are being lost. Currently, Rumler has nearly 1,000 community partners across all 87 Minnesota counties who help make our resources and services available to anyone. We have nearly 100 naloxone access points around the state where people can access our resources anonymously and at no cost to them. Our training calendar is full and requests are scheduled weeks out, and those are the ones we can fulfill. We are currently hearing from 1 to 2 new school districts every week asking us to walk them through scheduling a training for their staff, getting naloxone on site, and implementing a policy. Please review your handout for more specifics on our trusted history and work in Minnesota. When people say we need a method of mailing resources to individuals' homes for free, the answer is we do that. And people use these request forms every single day. However, not enough people know it exists, and therefore continued awareness campaigns are vital. Do you know what Steve's Law is? If your answer is no, then we're not doing enough. Allocating this funding would be to service the entire state of Minnesota. Prevention is a heavy lift that is not done in a silo, but instead as an enormous group effort. I would be here all week listing all the names, organizations, and groups that would receive assistance through this funding. Individuals, hospitals, detention centers, public safety, counties, detox withdrawal management, treatment centers, and yes, even our children and our schools. If none of what I've already said resonated and your heart is in your wallet, then I can speak on that too. If I'm being quite honest and you were to ask the state to fulfill this need, you would need to add a couple more zeros to this bill. Before you ask, I am an active member of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, also referred to as ORAC. ORAC has done some great work. However, ORAC is responsible for funding a vast spectrum of services affected by this crisis, in everything from pain management, medically assisted treatment, substance use disorder, etc. Far too often, the prevention side is being done entirely by nonprofits whose services do not ever include a fee-for-service line. Why? As an organization, we do everything in our power to eliminate potential barriers, and this way we can guarantee access and utilization. Prevention is an irrefutable and hungry beast that needs to be fed, and this bill would alleviate some of the state's needs by meeting more requests for overdose prevention and resources, fund awareness campaigns, ones that target many of the most impacted communities like the youth, Greater Minnesota, and with Cajogue, East African, and Somali. We do not have any capacity to take on novel awareness and education because the current demand is so high that we're struggling to just keep up and stay afloat. Because of this, nonprofits in this space are working around the clock, cutting costs, building partnerships, leaning on one another, and comparatively get very little compensation. So why? Simply put, because if not us, then who?
Thank you so much, Ms. House, for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. Farr. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of this committee, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear this very important bill for all Minnesotans. I would like to thank Madam Chair, Representative Hassan, for her leadership to bring this bill before you. My name is Mohammed Farah. I am the Executive Director of Cajogue, a nationally recognized Somali youth development organization tailored towards enriching the lives of Somali Americans by utilizing the positive elements of education, mentorship, employment, and the arts. On behalf of Minnesota youth and all Minnesotans, I urge you to support this bill before you. Cajogue was established in 2007 with a focus on the development of young people and families in making them as economically sufficient as possible. Our mission is to create a better world by providing community-based culturally specific programs and services to youth and their families through education, the arts, and economic development. An important and vital part of this work is our opioid outreach program, which we call Project CARE. Project CARE is built upon a foundation of hope and belief that the determination to seek opportunity amidst crisis is the first step towards ending an epidemic. We believe that there is a great deal of importance in unlocking and nurturing the awareness of an individual's self-worth and the human potential of people chained by addiction. Restorative empowerment is the approach that focuses on reigniting within someone the belief that they are worth more and revitalize their sense of purpose. The East African community has been and continue to be uniquely impacted by this crisis in so many ways. The community is also dealing with high level of stigma on opioid use, addiction, and mental health. The core elements of our program includes, but not limited to, opioid addiction awareness, increasing the number of East African leaders across the state, community members, and community-based organizations who are trained to administer and distribute naloxone kits and Narcan kits, increase access to naloxone and Narcan for East African African community members across our state, empower local partners and organizations to build a collaborative approach to tackle the opioid crisis through community health town halls and events and other avenues of community engagement across our state. Campaigns targeting community centers, schools, and other public and private sectors of where we see a need and benefit of preventive measures, and also provide wraparound services as needed. The need for this funding and the need for this funding is obvious and vital across our state. With your support of this committee, we can continue to do some great work throughout Minnesota. This committee and the state of Minnesota have great partners like Steve Rumler, Hope Network, and Kajok, who have been partnering on the ground for many years, the past years. Our two entities have been working together for the past years and have actually a long-term partnership. This is what nonprofits is about. We may not have the expertise, other folks do, and so that's why we partner with Steve Rumler, and it's been very, we've seen that, the impact that we've been doing together across our state. I would like to thank you all. I'd like to thank Chairman and also Madam Chair, Representative Hassan, for her leadership. And Mr. Chair, I would like to call on Hannah Sharaf, who is a member of the community, who wants to say a few words. Thank you so much.
Ms. Sharaf, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Hannah Sharaf. Mr. Chair and committee members, as an immigrant mother of two young adults in Minnesota, I urge you to support House File 2329 to increase awareness and protection for the East African community affected by the opioid epidemic. The East African community has been disproportionately impacted by opioid addiction, and too many lives have been lost as a result. This bill will provide access to life-saving tools like Naloxone and Narcan and empower local partners and organizations to build a collaborative approach to tackle the opioid crisis through community engagement. Please support House File 2329 to help the community, to help the immigrant community find the help they need to overcome the opioid epidemic and create a better future for our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and thanks for joining us today. With that, members, I see Representative Baker on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And again, thank you, Representative Hassan, for bringing this forward. You and I have chatted a little bit about this, and we've got more to go. Both organizations are very good organizations. I have relationships with both of them, and I will tell you that the Steve Rumler Foundation, from the very beginning, has been, I don't think we could count how many lives they've actually saved. It is probably the number one group out there that has painlessly and tirelessly driven every corner of the state of Minnesota to train people how to use it. They're EMTs, first responders, police officers, and they have gone on no sleep. I've seen it. I've been through their training. They are one of my heroes on this effort to try to keep people alive. Kajug and my friend Mohammed has also done a lot of work in this area, but we need to expand that further. We need to expand Kajug in rural Minnesota. We need to get it to some of the places around Minnesota that have populations of our East African community, because it's a different approach to that community. Mm-hmm. I have it in my community. I have been knocking my head against the wall to try to get my community to try to help me understand, what do we have to do? And it's not that simple in a culture that needs to do it their own way. And I'm trying to help understand that, and I know that Kajug and their outreach will be better, because your partnership is what this bill is about. So again, the taxpayers the families out there that have seen this firsthand. They expect us to make our dollars count in this area. We can't waste a single penny on this thing. And so not only just getting the Narcan out there, the naloxone, the training, our fentanyl strips. Steve Rumler, I've been there to their operation, and I've seen the bags ready for pickup, for people to come and grab more bags, more free stuff. It is amazing what they do. And we just need to do it on a bigger scale and to the communities that need a different approach. Our new Americans from the Somali community need this understanding of it, and we need to have their help to get it, to help them understand this. So, Mr. Chair, this is an important bill that I really do hope is a high priority of getting on our omnibus bill. I assume that's our plan here, but just this is important stuff. We, as well as the ORAC community, the council that you've heard about, we do a lot with also Steve Rumler, and it's in different areas. They're working on fentanyl awareness programs out there. They are doing a lot more than just naloxone training and disbursement. So thanks to both of you for being here. Thank you, Representative Hassan. You're another hero in this area, so thank you very much for this.
Thank you so much, Representative Baker. Representative Killen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this. Also, thank you, Representative Baker, for the work that you do in this realm. I do want to recognize and understand the work that you do here is really powerful. I love this, and I love this for my community of Moorhead, especially that at this moment in time, our law enforcement doesn't carry Narcan. And so that is terrifying to me. I think that we need to be prepared and ready at all times with all communities and making sure that we understand the importance of culture and how we maneuver differently when we have different cultural understandings and making sure that we see the importance in that. So I appreciate you doing this, and I really do hope that this expands to all the communities across Minnesota in a really positive way. Thank you.
With that, your closing remarks, Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Keeler and Rep. Baker. I remember talking to Rep. Baker about the fentanyl issue, and I was asking him, where the heck are these fentanyls coming from? Why are there so many, lace fentanyl, opioids in our streets? I represent a community that has a funeral every weekend because of fentanyl. And someone tried to explain this to me in the sense of I am from the mental health world. Someone from the behavior health and the chemical health world tried to explain this to me. They said when someone has trauma in their background, they do not have the power to use anything recreationally. It's a straight addiction. So this explains why, like, so many young people, young East Africans and so many young people from the PIPAC folks as well as the, indigenous community are addicting to this, because there is trauma. There's a pain that people are trying to numb because they don't know how to communicate that pain to us and how to get the help that they need. All I want to say is this is a good bill. It will be saving lives, and we are here to make people's lives better and save lives. So please support. Thank you.
Hearing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2329 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Chair Hassan. The next bill is House File 1633. Representative Richardson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce the bill. I'll first move the House File 1633 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1633 would provide a direct appropriation to the African American Wellness Child Institute. And as the intent is to hold this bill over, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your willingness to continue to work with us on refining the language and the scope of the bill. There is no debate that we have a mental health crisis in Minnesota and within our nation, and it's one that has existed for decades. In fact, a recent Kaiser Family Foundation study found that 9 out of 10 adults believe that there is a significant mental health crisis within the United States. We know that there are also significant disparities in access to mental health services, and there is a need for culturally specific services. And so often within our communities, there's a long wait list to access culturally specific services. Some of the disparities that it's important that I think that the committee recognize, adolescents who are Black, Indigenous, or Latin have lower rates of mental health and or depression screening compared with their white peers. 9% of high schoolers overall reported attempting suicide in the most recent data year, along with 12% of Black students. A recent Blue Cross Blue Shield study showed major depression goes undiagnosed and untreated at disproportionately greater rates in Black communities. And furthermore, treatment rates are lower for Black communities. And there are also disparities in prescription drug treatment and counseling rates. NAMI estimates that 1 in 3 Black adults with mental illness receive treatment, which also means that for those who are not getting access to treatment, they are more frequently using our emergency rooms to get their care. And we know without access to counseling, treatment, and services, and without a diagnosis, people are not receiving important treatments. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn my time over to the testifiers.
Very well. Thank you so much, Representative Richardson. The first testifier I have is Dr. Garrett Akisanya.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya. I'm an executive director of the African American Child Wellness Institute, AACWI ECWI. And I'm here to speak in support of House File 1633. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist with over 40 years of experience in the field of mental health, serving clients whose ages range from birth to death. That means infants all the way to geriatrics. I am a fellow of the American Psychological Association and a board certified diplomat and fellow in African-centered Black psychology. I am the past president of both the Minnesota Psychological Association and the Minnesota Association of Black Psychologists. I have written, presented, and consulted extensively in the areas of developmental psychology, women's issues, trauma, community violence, multiculturalism, poverty, homelessness, severe psychopathology, and African American mental health. ACWI is a nonprofit 501c3 Rule 29 community mental health center located in North Minneapolis as well as in Plymouth, Minnesota. We provide mental health services across the state, reaching clients in places such as Rochester, Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth, and the metro area. ACWI's mission is to promote the psychological and spiritual liberation of children of African descent and their families by providing culturally specific mental health services and by developing access to culture-based, holistic wellness resources, research, and practices. Through DHS's CIMIC program, it's a Cultural Ethnic Minority Infrastructure Grant, ACWI has been able to provide clinical and ancillary services to connect uninsured and underinsured children and their families to the culturally specific mental health providing services that we provide. We also provide capacity building for licensure for African American clinicians to gain training and clinical supervision in culturally congruent, trauma-informed, practice-based, and evidence-based strategies. Through the CIMIC program, we have trained 47 African-American clinicians to licensure. But due to the inadequate funding of the program and in our organization, we have not been able to keep but one of them, which we got back because we got a grant and was able to bring her back. Recently, due to additional funding, we've been able to bring back 4 more of our past graduates from our program who are licensed in mental health. One of them today will speak, Ms. Kalina Peterson. But one of the things that happened is we were unable to provide competitive salaries. Thus, we lost those licensed providers. And we also provide community-based outreach services to psychoeducational to provide psychoeducational and behavioral health to children and their families via public education programs and activities. So the problem is, as has been stated, it's no secret that African American children and families in Minnesota experience severe disparities in multiple systems, including education, foster care, criminal justice, mental health. Sadly, a recent Minnesota student survey showed that while 15% of black children, ninth graders, reported having long-term mental health and behavioral emotional health problems, only 9% of those children ever experienced even one counseling session. So these systemic practices have a deleterious effect and impact on the lives of African American youth and have a glaring impact on the issues of safety, trauma, suicide, drug abuse, and exposure to violence. Our psychological research shows us that health outcomes for black patients are better when they are treated by black providers. That research is critical given that African Americans in the United States experience poor health outcomes across a variety of diseases and conditions. And if we invest on moving black youth and families from being in a perspective of being at risk to seeing them in a perspective of being at promise, the trajectory of their lives can be positively changed. Your support of HF 1633 will do the following: expand access to culturally specific and comprehensive mental health services to African American children and adults. It will increase the number of licensed mental health providers of African descent in the workforce who can then render culturally proficient care to children and adults of African descent. It will support at-risk, rather at promise, parents, whether they face circumstances of poverty, mental illness, substance abuse, physical health challenges. And it will also support the development of innovative, collaborative models for service delivery among people of African descent. Minnesota will be a leader in doing something that is specifically designed for this community that has been overrepresented and underserved. And with that, I say thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Garrett Akisanya. And the next person on the list is Al McFarlane. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. It's good to see you here.
Good to see you. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Richardson. My name is Al McFarlane. I am the owner and president of McFarlane Media. McFarlane Media produces Insight News and weekly and daily social media digital programs, and I have the fortune of serving as board member and chairman of the board of the African American Child Wellness Institute. It's a pleasure and a duty and an obligation to be here with you today. The duty and obligation come from my belief, my commitment to promoting the idea that healing is available and at hand in our community right now. My belief that the work of Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya and her team at the African American Child Wellness Institute is innovative, is creative, and is transformative. Transformative because it seeks to redefine the conditions that we have become used to as opportunities. It seeks to redefine our response not as a crying or victim focused response, but as an enabling problem solving response. Dr. B, as we call her affectionately, is leading the charge in helping redefine to create new narratives about conditions we experience, the trauma we experience, but also our capacity, our ability to see ourselves as the solution to the problem. And so I'm here to invite you and to praise you for being able to join us in this vision of empowerment and of creating capability in our community so that we come to community, to ourselves and to the state as men and women, as families committed to and able to solve problems, your partners in problem solving. Thank you.
Thank you so much. The next person on the list is Brianna Kennedy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Ms. Kennedy, and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Hello, my name is Kiana Kennedy.
Get closer, honey.
Huh?
Raise up the shirt.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep.
My name is Kiana Kennedy, and I am a parent. My child received counseling from Dr. B. And I wrote a little statement that I would like to read. My son is now 16 years old, and he received counseling from when he was 6 to maybe like 12. I am honored to be here today to speak on behalf of the bill to fund a culturally specific agency such as African American Child Wellness Institute. I come today to talk about the importance of culturally specific mental health of African American children and their parents like me. My experience of coming to counseling in a place that specialized in my culture was life-changing. I felt safe because the atmosphere and the staff validated who we were. They understood the struggles I faced and, more importantly, the struggles my son faced. And that created a comforting and welcoming environment. Sometimes I would be in tears because my child would get into trouble at school, and I did not know what to do. My concerns were about what happens to little black boys who don't learn the skills to ask for help and the tools needed to manage their emotions in school and other public places where they might not feel welcome or misunderstood. In my opinion, this puts them at risk for joining gangs, going to prison, or ending up dead. They don't know how to cope, or they don't know where to go to seek help. I feel like this problem, the problems my son faced, would have escalated by now had I not seek help early on. Because of my quick response to my son's behavioral issues, he now has a lifetime bag of tools that he can pull from when dealing with difficult situations. I feel like therapy has taught him how to express himself, and it also gave him the skills to reach out for help as a normal thing to do. I am now proud of a mother of a confident, loving young man who was a junior in high school with A's and B's, who was in the process of starting his own company and learning business credit. Without African American Child Wellness Institute, I wouldn't even want to imagine where we would be. As a parent, I also participated in free Project Mabul parenting classes. After going through Project Mabul, I gained a lot of skills and learned techniques about how to discipline and communicate with our children as African American parents. We also learned how to use each other as resources, and having the input of other mothers and fathers built a sense of community, and that was great. Again, my son once had trouble being in class, has now demonstrated that he is on a direct path to greatness. And that means everything to me, because I know that when it's time to put him into the world, he has skills to cope, and that makes me feel happy that I could provide him with that. In closing, I fully support funding culturally specific agencies like African American Child Wellness Institute, because I can trust people like Dr. B and her staff to competently care about me and my child and our community. For that, I am grateful.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and sharing your story with us. The next person is Kalina Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My name is Dr. Kalina Peterson. I am here as a former trainee of the African American Child Wellness Institute, also known as ACWI, and also as the current assistant clinic director. And obviously I'm here in support of Bill HF 1633. When I decided to pursue an undergraduate degree in psychology, I could not fathom that I would be sitting here today with a doctorate degree and as a licensed clinical psychologist. I had not encountered a black therapist or mental health professional at that time. I simply thought, I want to be something my friends and I wish we had while navigating life and the countless adversities we faced growing up in Gary, Indiana, a place that held the title of murder capital of the U.S. during my adolescent years. After completing my bachelor's degree, I entered a graduate program here in Minnesota to become a school counselor. There, I was taught by great professors with advanced degrees who were doing the exact work I desired to do. I was grateful for the education, while I remained hyper aware that none of the people teaching me or doing this work looked like me. I was introduced to Dr. Bravada Garrett Akinsanya during my last year of graduate school and interned at her practice. She was the first black psychologist I'd ever met, and it was the first time I felt seen as a black therapist in training. Dr. Bravada was everything I wanted to be and so much more. She taught me to relentlessly advocate for our people, not just in the therapist chair, but also through staff trainings, consultations, leadership roles, and community activism. My mind and eyes were open to the many possibilities this field of work held for me and the various ways I could be impactful and serve the African-American community. African-American providers are essential in reducing the stigma towards mental health and seeking treatment that continues to plague our people today. It was through Dr. Bravada's encouragement and inspirational example and passion she has for this work that I chose to pursue my doctorate degree in clinical psychology. I am only one of many who have been inspired by her. She has sparked trails for countless other practitioners of color, and there is no way I would be where I am today without the culturally specific training and experiences with ACWI. It is absolutely crucial that funding be devoted to the recruitment and training of more African Americans in the mental health profession so that we can meet the demands of the African American community and provide the quality care they deserve. There are so many more people to reach, and our work is far from done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson, for your testimony. With that, I just wanted to ask if there's anyone else in the public who wanted to testify on the bill. Seeing none, hearing none, we will go to member discussions. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, and to our testifiers. I just have to say, I was reading the handout in our packets, and I have to say, this is one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. AACWI's mission is to promote the psychological and spiritual liberation of children. That is beautiful. So thank you for that. And we've heard a lot about the need. I don't think anyone in this room disagrees, and certainly we see all the same things that you see, and we are certainly disturbed by those things. I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit. I know you got $1 million grant from DHS last year, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what you did with that grant and what, I mean, I know what the grant is, what it can be used for in the language, but I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more about what your vision is and how you see this money being used in practice.
Thank you so much. I'm more than happy to talk
about it. Dr. Garrett. Yeah, Akisanya, go ahead, please.
I don't want to be out of order.
No, you're not out of order. You can proceed.
Okay, sorry about that. So the money that we got, it went through RFP process, and it did not come to us as a direct allocation because our name wasn't on the bill. So the Department of Human Services had to offer it through an RFP process that actually just concluded in January. And so, but with that promise of hoping that we would get that money, we were able to solicit funds from private organizations that said, okay, they believe in you, we believe in you, we'll give you a little money. And frankly, Dr. Peterson didn't say, but she's one of the four people that I talked about earlier that we got back from Chicago. We went to fetch her, and she came back to work with us. So she's a living example of what it means when you put that level of integrity, professionalism, and expertise into a person, how it can come back. Now, with the money that we have planned and are using, we have already started doing things like increasing our groups. Currently, we have 8,872 hours of service that we are providing with the staff that we have, serving maybe a little bit over 1,000, almost 2,000 people. And this is our little group. But now we're hoping that with this money that we're asking for, we know we have the capacity to provide 36,560, according to our data analysts, 560 hours of therapy moving forward. So the reason that it can happen is because what occurs is we hire people, we train them. Once you're trained, you can supervise people who aren't licensed under you, so your training is exponentially increased. And those people in our clinic, they serve 20 to 25 direct client hours per week or more. So because most of therapy isn't just in front of the client, especially with children, you have to coordinate care. You better go to the IEP meetings. You have to go to schools and homes and different places to work with the clients. So those hours would be devoted. And I think that would be a phenomenal effort if we could do something like that. And that's what our plan is. So we're on track. For example, every single week when I go out, Mr. McFarland didn't talk about the fact that there is a
podcast that we do called The Healing Circle. And every week we address an issue of healing for our community. And every single week, it's on Friday, by Tuesday or Wednesday, I have 43 or 53 new referrals in my inbox. We don't have the capacity to cover them. That's why we need this money, because we're now getting our community to the fact that they understand that it's okay to say it hurts. It's okay to say, ouch. It's okay not to be a working machine. They know now that there can be help. Now that they're asking, we need your help so that we can provide the critically needed, culturally specific skill set that makes it successful for our communities. And I hope that answered your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, thank you for that. That was excellent. Follow-up question. You clearly need capacity. I think it's fascinating that you pulled her back from Chicago, because one of the things we talk about here a lot at the legislature is workforce and the fact that the people don't exist to do the jobs. So I think it's interesting that you pulled her back from Chicago, because that tells me how you can bring people in. And so I guess I would ask, I have not heard about an institute like this, a clinic like this. How unique is this? And I don't know if this is for you, Representative, or, I apologize, I don't know how to say your last name.
Dr. Garrett Akisanya.
But Dr. B, is that what everybody's been
calling
you?
That's fine.
Because I can do that.
Yes.
I'm wondering how unique is this both in Minnesota and across the country?
It's very unique. Okay, thank you.
No problem.
It's very unique. When DHS did the referral, did the RFP, we were the only group that qualified fully for the grant. And the reason is because we structure it so that it's not just a therapy institute, it's a training institute. And so those two things combined, and it's culturally specific. We know that our expertise is to keep African-American children from going to jail or dying, and to help our communities from birth on up to geriatrics. Our youngest client right now is 16 months. The oldest is 87. So we provide a safe space for people to come. We use telehealth. We go places. We travel. We do whatever we need to do to get people engaged who are asking for help. And we're creating a different environment that means that we have the right to be well. We have a right to be well. And there's an African saying that says one does not go hunting when your house is on fire. Our houses have been on fire for decades, centuries. And now we're finally figuring out that mental health and all of the ecological spaces, jobs, spirituality, finances, all of those things play a role in one being holistically healthy. And that's what we're doing, and it is unique. I'm a leader nationally. Nobody's doing what we're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just last comment, I will say, no one will be surprised. I'm a little uncomfortable with the numbers. Like, this is a significant increase over what you've got now. That said, certainly I support this. And I have to say, like I said, when we talk about workforce, when we talk about you coming back from Chicago, I'm just imagining anyone who has an opportunity to come to work with you, Dr. B, they're going to do that.
You're coming back. Yeah.
Chair Richard, Representative Richardson, did you want to comment on that? I know we were going to work on the numbers.
Oh, I was just going to make a comment in terms of the teaching piece of the work that you do and sort of that center of excellence model. It is something that is used at the University of Minnesota, but it's not culturally specific. So just wanted to lift up that the model itself is used in other places, but it is unique in terms of the culturally specific components of it.
Representative Francis Flatty.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative Richardson. Thank you so much for bringing this bill. With it being culturally specific, it does make a difference. And the aspect of unpacking trauma or understanding the cultural trauma in going forward makes a large difference. And as a teacher, I just know evidence-based is really important, and you're right there, too. So this is a really good bill, and I look forward to supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And listening, what came to mind was developing a peer-to-peer network, to help and leverage what you're doing, because a lot of your activities seem like they would blend well to that type of thing. And then Mr. McFarland, leveraging social media to reach the youth, because oftentimes they might not hear you, but they'll see it on this. And those type of ways to broaden the penetration. And the other thing is, frankly, I think some of the root contributors are the lack of a bright horizon of dreams. And in the community, planting the seeds of the possible, so that then they've got a dream. And if you've got that bright thing you're going for, it's easier to get through the tougher times. And it motivates, and I don't know if you've got examples of successes in the community of where people have gone through, and they discovered, and now they're a doctor, a lawyer, a engineer, a teacher, and then when they see that someone four houses down or in the same apartment building did it, or the sister of somebody that they go to school with did it. Mm-hmm. I think that is like a drink of cold water on a hot day.
Yes, it is.
So I look forward to hearing more. I'm just hoping that you leverage some of these other techniques, because not one way is going to reach everyone, even if they're in the same community. Thank you.
Right. Any further discussion, members? Dr. Garrett Akisanya, do you want to respond quickly?
Yes, I just wanted to say I'm getting excited because I feel like I'm having church in here. And the reason I feel it is because when I look in this group, I don't know all of you personally, but I feel like I got allies. And I'm not on this journey by myself. And one of the things that one of our biggest successes that our parent talked about is called Project Marua. And the word Marua in Swahili means respect. And it's a boot camp for parents. It's called Project Marua Premeditated Parenting Boot Camp. So they can think about what they do as strategically as parents. Now that program, they come in, the parents come for 3 hours a week for 10 weeks. You hear me? 3 hours a week for 10 weeks to learn how to be strong, helping children learn about each model. One is on financial wellness, academic wellness, physical wellness, cultural wellness, spiritual wellness. They go through this model that we have, an African-centered wellness model, and it's value-based. So they learn values and how to model and what? Teach and model to their children. And what happens when they graduate? The parents come back as facilitators. So they become teachers of other parents. Because they, if you're a parent talking to another parent, you got street creds. A psychologist, they may not believe so much until they hear it from another parent. So the vision you had about using peers, not just locally but nationally, that is one that I share. And so this program, and that's why we're asking, it needs funding. It can't walk without having support. And we have a vision, and I invite all of you, I'm from Texas originally, all of y'all to come and help if you feel like if it feels like you want to do it. We have plenty of room for volunteers. Plenty, plenty, plenty. And so the reason we lost so many staff is we couldn't afford them. So if we can get the money, we can bring them back and train a new set. So I'm just excited about being, I was scared at first, but I'm not now. Maybe I should be, but I'm not.
Thank you so much, Dr. Garrett Akisanya. With your closing remarks, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank all of the testifiers and the Institute as well. I think we have a real opportunity here with this community care model. It's one that centers the community, family, and faith, and the importance of those things in the lives of African Americans. And I think that with the workforce shortage that we know that exists within the state, this work is creating a pipeline of individuals as well. And so I just don't want it to be lost that the work that is being done is creating a pipeline to new providers and creating lifelines for communities. I do just want to say that Dr. B was a huge lifeline to community, especially in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. She did lots of work around community healing, lots of circles as well, and I just want to lift up the fact that this work is indeed a lifeline for a community. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present.
Thank you so much, Representative Richardson. I think we will keep on working on this bill and look forward to working with you. With that, I renew my motion that House File 1633 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill is House File 2550.
Hip surgery, and that's what I'm trying to get, that hip surgery. That's what I'm doing. Mm-mm-mm.
Doing great work. Vice Chair Benner, please move your bill and introduce.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2550 before the committee, and I believe the intent here is to potentially lay it over for possible inclusion.
Very well, and I see you've got A1 amendment.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, the A1 amendment, unfortunately, as we all know, there's been some challenges getting things drafted, and there was, in fact, unfortunately, some drafting errors here. So really, we just want to kind of technically clean that up. It does modify the rate to what it was actually intended to be, as well as removing some language that sort of excludes psychologists, which is the whole point of the bill.
With that, Vice Chair Banner moves A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape of the other ones. Any discussions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So instead of 23.7%, it'll be a 50% increase in the rates?
Vice Chair.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Let all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The A1 amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature passed a major mental health reform package. Within that new law, there was a rate increase for critical access mental health care under the medical assistance program. Psychiatrists and advanced practice nurses in psychiatry were given a rate increase, but unfortunately, licensed psychologists were inadvertently excluded. These are the individuals who do the vast majority of therapy and counseling, as well as clinical texts. They were not included. It is an unfortunate oversight that for the past 15 years, the Minnesota Psychological Association, or MPA, has been trying to correct. The last time this bill was heard in the House was roughly 7 years ago. In the intervening years, of course, focus shifted a little bit to things like telehealth and addressing the mental health crisis. We see these issues in the mental health space continue to rise to a crisis level, and we need every resource at the table to address it. That includes psychologists who play a vital role. Then and now, members of both chambers and both parties have expressed for righting this wrong traditionally. This bill has the direct impact on these highly qualified professionals with an average of 12 years of education and over 4,000 hours of supervised training, rising all the way up to the doctoral level, and who do this very passionate and critical work in the mental health space. And with that, I do have with me today Dr. Steve Girardo, who also has some testimony in your packets with some graphs and charts to assist you to speak to the bill.
Dr. Girardo, welcome. Please introduce yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Steve Girardo. I am a licensed psychologist in Minnesota, and I've been here for a very long time, noting the gray hair that I bring to the table here. I am also the co-chair of the Legislative Committee and been part of trying to get this bill through for the last 15 years. And so here I am, once again, trying to move this forward. I feel pretty qualified to actually talk about this because I actually was a master level psychologist originally, and after 7 years I went back and got my doctorate, and in those intervening years of education I learned a lot more and became a much better clinician, because psychologists have a greater depth of training than typical mental health providers. Licensed mental health providers, we're trained in neurological, biological, social, relational, cognitive, and behavioral sources of mental health disorders in a way that isn't really possible in a two-year degree. You'll notice that there are a lot of statistics here. We're also trained in statistics and the science of behavior. We do research to support the work that we do. While this high level of training isn't necessarily needed for everybody, ironically, for people that are on medical assistance, Medicaid, they're the probably most complex cases that we have in front of us today. And they are receiving the least amount of money for payment for services. And so the highest level trained people are not reimbursed enough for them to be able to do the work. And so the majority of services provided to Medicaid mental health clients are provided to them by trainees who are supervised possibly by psychologists or other licensed professionals. But it just isn't possible to kind of pay the rate that's paid and have it continue that way. During the time from 1999 to 2015, the cost of doctorates in psychology has increased 125%, from $65,000 to $147,000. That's a significant increase, but that isn't actually the real number to pay attention to. The real number to pay attention to is to become a doctor in psychology, you have to go to school, you have all the school ahead of it, then you also have to go to school and you have to live. And you all have heard over and over again that it is impossible on part-time jobs, much less a full-time job, to be able to pay your living expenses. And so the debt load that is carried by the average psychologist that comes out of school today is between $160,000 and $224,000. That's an incredible debt load to carry when the rates that are paid are so low. And so you have to make choices that are going to help pay your mortgage. The median salary for a doctoral level clinical psychologist in 2001 was $72,000. In 2021, it's $82,500. That is not a very big increase, and that is from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics data. It's a 14% over 20 years. Inflation during that same period went up 53%. Using the Minnesota Federal Reserve Inflation Calculator, the pay rate adjusted for the $72,000, the pay rate should be $110,175. That's a very significant lack of pay. We're talking about a third of reduction in pay, and approximately 130% increase in the educational cost that are carried forward. What has happened in our state is that we had a rate increase for special programs, but we were not included in that special programs. I truly believe that we are critical need providers. I actually work in an agency where we provide services to high-risk clients who are working through suicidality and chronic depression and chronic anxiety, providing DBT services, and we're also a training site, which is part of how we're able to do it and how I'm able to know that really you need to rely on master's level trainees and master's level clinicians to try and get there. Why does it matter? If we're so far off in pay, people are going to make different choices about what they're going to do with education. My son, he actually did not go into mental health. He went into policy and public planning, kind of your realm of the world. He does transportation work. He got a job that paid $5,000 more than the entry-level salary for a psychologist, for a doctoral-level psychologist. If you don't believe this is a crisis, this is a capitalist society. It's a market-based society. Mm-hmm. Ironically, you know, serendipitously, yesterday morning I received an email from a Canvas Health, a pretty large provider in the Stillwater area, and they're offering a $10,000 retention bonus for psychologists. That's how much competition there is for people as a licensed psychologist. We as an agency, while a for-profit agency, are not for very much profit agency, we're actually funding a scholarship at St. Mary's to try and bring people in from underserved communities into the profession, trying to help make that happen. But we really need help at the other end. Bravada, who I'm glad you all could meet because I've known her for decades. She's a force of nature, and you got to see that. I fully support her bill. They're at the front end, you know, providing the training, but at the end of all that training, if there's not enough income to be able to pay your debts and have the living that you want, you're not going to continue working that. So that's why she's having to chase people across the country to get them to work for her. I also do supervision for doctoral level interns, and I was talking to one of the interns I was working with this week, talking about coming to testify this week, and she said, I guess I want to tell you a story, and that is that I'm finishing my internship, but me and my partner have decided not to have children because we can't afford to have a home and have this debt load that we're carrying. It's that they literally have chosen to not have children because they're carrying a second, like a mortgage, before they even buy a house, before they really enter their career. And so this is causing a crisis, and it's a crisis that isn't going to have a quick solution. You change this today, and people start looking at, okay, so this is going to, we're going to be able to have a living wage. It takes like 5 to 7 years to create a psychologist, and that's if they've made the determination to be a psychologist at the bachelor's level. I'm happy to see what Bravada is doing, because she's actually making people consider the career, but if we don't take care of the other end of it, we're really going to be paying a price in the future. I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Don't see anyone else signed up. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this? See none. We'll go to member discussions. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm totally absorbing what you're saying about the critical importance of increasing compensation for this really important work. And it's just, I'm having trouble. I just want to make sure I understand, because there's words that say provide non-critical access providers providing critical actual services, and I'm just a little bit confused on how that works, and just trusting absolutely that this is something that we need to do, but wanting to understand a little bit more clearly the group of people that we're increasing for, and that, you know, that this is the mechanism for doing it.
Dr. Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative, for the question. I didn't write the original bill, and so the intent of the original bill is somewhat opaque to me. But one of the things that was noted at the time was that psychiatrists weren't just, it wasn't just about facilities. I believe it wasn't just facility-based, because we have a crisis in that we don't have enough psychiatrists, and that's not a secret. That's still a massive issue, especially for child psychiatry. Mm-hmm. This is the same issue, is that it isn't just about the location. It's literally about having enough psychologists out there to do the work that you need to do. If you want to get a neuropsych screening, it's months and months and months to be able to get anybody in and to do it, because it literally is not paid enough, and so people can't do it. And so we're not producing enough psychologists to do something that only psychologists can do. And so I think we are clearly within the definition of what a critical access provider is, not by location, but literally by what the profession is trained to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. I think I'm getting the gist of what's going on, is that we're not tying it to locations, as you just said, but just making sure that we are compensating the people that are doing the work at this higher and necessarily higher rate in order to have the job be worthwhile. So thank you.
And
Dr. Girard.
Sorry, I was out of order. Bravada, she's catching, you know. I just thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. The reality is that we need to have more psychologists out there, and it cannot be tied to location. And one of the realities is that I know people in the outstate area that were looking to have a psychologist, a doctoral level psychologist. They needed to hire a doctoral level psychologist for their continued qualification for services. They couldn't hire them because they couldn't offer enough money for it. And so it isn't even just about anybody anywhere. It's those critical access places not being able to find a psychologist and support them because they don't have the income to support the salary needs. Thank you.
Representative Francis Clady.
I'm kind of formulating this question as we are talking. I had a psychiatrist come visit me today in my office, and they were talking about a new system that they were trying through Fairview Hospital, where basically they have general practitioners as being like the first level because of the shortage, and then a referral. Is this anything that you would be involved in, or is this something that's practical? I mean, it sounds pragmatic in the sense that, you know, there is a shortage and there's some maybe entry level, because the way it was explained to me is because he's a doctor that he could do some entry-level diagnosis, but is this just complicating what your life?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The question's a good one, but it also is kind of rooted in not really understanding how things work. In medical school, doctors will go through a rotation in psychiatry, possibly, but that rotation is a very short rotation and they don't receive additional training in it. The majority of medications are prescribed by physicians, but the majority of research shows that medications alone are insufficient. The other reality is that general practitioners, adding another thing that general practitioners are doing, we don't have enough general practitioners already. And the work that we're doing with the clients that are most in need, it's not a 5-minute conversation. It's not a 15 minutes of conversation. It's a long conversation. The work that I do, actually, Minnesota actually made a decision quite a number of years ago to actually fund DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, for people that are chronically depressed and suicidal. And they actually decided to pay for all of it themselves through the Medicaid dollars, because CMS said, we're not going to give you federal money because we have to go through a different process to do that. And they have found it to be far more worth the money, but this is a process that takes a year. And so having a general practitioner working with the population, because we're literally talking about working with the most complex cases. That's what psychologists should be doing. Psychologists should not be sitting in office with somebody who is having marital issues, because that's, you know, you're having a Ferrari to go around the block. And the thing is that we actually as an agency have lost people, and we regularly lose people to being able to earn far more money doing private practice out in the world. And so there's just no way that that's going to work. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, just that was just something Fairview is putting out, so I just wanted to put it out here. That's not my field. I totally understand. I do have an undergraduate degree in psychology, so I know, you know, the nuances of the field. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Zaleski.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill, and thank you, Doctor, for being here today. I just want to concur with your points on the training in medical school doesn't always give the subsets for geriatric behaviors and adolescent behaviors and psychology and all the other things that is going on with mental health. And so right now the hospitals are full across the state as we gather here this today. And children are not being able to be placed, and adults that are seniors can't get placed, and there are adults that are in between that can't get placed. And the reason they can't get placed is there's no place to have them go to have the appropriate services, so we're keeping them in the highest cost center right now. And that is happening every day, and not just for one person. I think we would be shocked if we saw the numbers, because I've talked to many ER doctors across the state who tell me how many patients are in their facilities. So I think I commend you for the bill, and I think it's really important that we start growing, just like we're doing everything, growing teachers, growing healthcare providers, growing experts in what this is, because mental health is an area that is requires a depth of understanding to really understand all the things the other presenters have shared with various members here that sit on other committees of these ACE factors and what those stressors, understanding trauma and understanding it. So I'm a big fan of having the right people at the table for the right situations. And with mental health, I think it's that serious. And I support the initiatives to get proper credentialing for the people. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions, and I just wanted to clarify first, Representative Bonner. It sounded like you said in your amendment you deleted the independent clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists, et cetera. In your initial testimony, did you say that that group had already been included in rate increases, that this group had been excluded from?
Question. Yeah.
Give you a little more in-depth answer.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Bill Amberg, Amberg Law Office. I represent the Minnesota Psychological Association. So as we all know, bill drafting has been very challenging the last few months. When I got a draft well into the session, what I thought we had talked about, I didn't get in the jacket. And at that point, we knew the jackets were a huge problem. And I said, I actually was talking to the Senate author, former Representative Morrison, first, and she said, well, I don't think we can risk getting a perfect jacket because it might be April, so let's just get it going and do an author's amendment when we get to committee. As far as I can tell, this is from a bill from several years ago, and it might have been, I'm not going to throw the revisers under the bus, it might have been me looking back, was it the 91st, 92nd, so kind of before the pandemic when we were working on this in earnest, and then we kind of put it on the back burner because telehealth expansion, the state psychology compact, which was, you know, really key right on this issue. So that's why.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. So have those other groups already had rate increases, or why are they excluded from this language?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I explained, it was an earlier draft from years ago. I think maybe there was an author 6-7 years ago. Right. I think there was an earlier draft that maybe the author of the bill back then, nine years ago, wanted to look at those other clinicians for a rate increase. And I don't know if that bill ever got a hearing, but as I said, it was a drafting error, and that was just meant to clean this up.
Lead Newburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, it might be worth considering whether these other groups also need rate increases. I suspect that they do. And to our testifier,
question, just digging a little deeper on Representative Pryor's question about the critical access service provided by non-critical access providers. And as you indicated, this shouldn't be based on location. I think we all agree with that. But my question is there a difference when we're talking about critical access service providers? Is the bulk of their service given to patients on state programs versus non-critical access providers? Do they have a larger percentage of their business that is private pay or private insurance pay that would be naturally higher rates?
Dr. Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So the confusion is rampant, I get that. But I didn't include in my testimony anything about the other licensees because it wasn't kind of my primary question, but I did look at the data for master's level clinicians, it's actually their pay rate has actually kind of stayed close, and I mean very close to the rate of inflation. And so it's psychologists that have really been left behind in this, and it's not just within Medicaid rates, it's within insurance rates and kind of across the board, but we can't solve that here. Your question of is that the majority of their practice? Sadly, no, it isn't, and it isn't because of the very reason that they have the debt to pay, and so they get lured away to work in other agencies where they can be paid at a much higher rate. I have a lot of clinicians that have left our agency that are now doing cash only business, and because they're a doctoral level psychologist, they can actually command that, and the issues that they're facing are really pretty non-complex in the most cases. I'm not saying that there aren't complex cases, but they're going to be leaning towards just private pay clients with marital issues, occupational issues, kind of standard general mental health issues. But this has been something that's been a problem in the system, and it's a problem in the Medicare system as well, is that Medicare has incredible requirements, including you have to be a doctoral level psychologist, but you're paid at a rate that isn't enough to actually fund your work. And so this is a part of a system, and what this is about trying to access the funds to write this so that people will stay and do the work with these populations, because we can afford to pay them enough to have them stay. As an employer, it is heartbreaking for me to train people, and we take four interns a year, pre-doctoral interns a year, with the expectation that after a year or two after they're completed, they're going to roll out and do other things. Solely because we cannot financially compete with private practice.
Thank you, Mr.
We have
Chair.
One more bill. I just wanted to inform that.
Yep. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation. So, Representative Bonner, and frankly, Chair Noor, I don't envy your position of weeding through all of these bills at the end and trying to figure out what percentages are going to make sense and what are not. That is going to be a big job, and certainly I think all of us, we all understand the problem in mental health and making sure that it is funded properly. I would just suggest that, you know, our critical access providers are given other funding as well outside of just their reimbursement rates, and so there is an incentive to be a critical access provider. I understand that certainly there are areas of the state that would be underserved and would benefit from this. I question a little bit how this is all being presented. And so, like I said, Chair Noor, I do not envy your position of figuring out what this would be. And I guess it will be interesting to see what the fiscal note would be. Maybe the fiscal note ultimately would not be that significant because we do have quite a shortage. But that would be interesting to see. I would also say I'm a little bit concerned. I don't see that this bill. Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. With that, if you want to renew your motion, Vice Chair Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to also just kind of come back and remind us that, you know, these are providers who are working at the top of their level, who are handling very medically complex cases, which is what happens in the MA space. And so those skills are sorely needed in this space. And so I just want to make sure we ground in that. And with that, I do want to renew my motion that we lay over House File 2550 for possible inclusion.
Vice Chair Bunn renews her motion that House File 2550 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. So the next bill, the final bill, is 2553. Chair Fisher. 2523, sorry. We haven't
received. Thank you, Chair Nora. I was a little confused there. I was going, I don't think it's that. So thank you. I'd like to move House File 2523 to be laid over. May I go ahead, Chair Nora?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nor. Committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2523. I'd also like to thank my co-authors on this bipartisan bill. I have Representative Schumacher, Keel, and Chair Nor, who are also co-authors of the bill. What this bill does is it provides funding for meals to older adults. These programs have been severely underfunded over the past years and are not meeting the needs of our oldest who are living among us. The Minnesota Senior Nutrition Program funding has not increased in the past 20 years, and during this time, the cost of meals have grown, and at the same time, we've seen demand for services increase greatly in our senior population. According to the Defeat Malnutrition Today, as many as one in two older Americans is at risk for malnutrition. Lack of nutrition puts people at high risk for illness, longer lengths of hospital stays, and higher levels of readmissions. Malnutrition is complex and driven by multiple factors, but the lack of access to nutritious meals is a key component. Meals programs also assist in keeping individuals in their homes. A home-delivered meal provides older opportunities with a regular in-person visit. Congregate meal sides of the program help create opportunities for people to gather and have social interactions. While need has been increasing for some time, during COVID, there were extra federal dollars that came in to help. Those dollars are no longer available. So to make sure that we have the nutritious meals plans being available for our seniors, we want to make sure we have appropriate funding. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers because I know we're short on time.
The first testifier I have is Ms. Swanson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you for being here. Good afternoon, Chair Noren, members of the committee. My name is Dawn Simonson, and I'm the president and CEO of Trellis. We're the state-designated area agency on aging for the metro region. And I'm here today representing the Senior Meals and Services Coalition and the Association of Area Agencies on Aging. So the role of Area Agencies on Aging is that we receive funds that flow from the state, and we distribute them to trusted local provider partners who deliver meals and who provide congregate dining. And we're here today to ask the legislature to increase biennial funding for the Senior Nutrition Program by $20 million. Now, current state funding is $5.39 million, and as Representative Fisher said, it has not increased in decades. Core federal funding is flat at approximately $24 million for the biennium. Now, in 2022, even with COVID funding, we still had 828 older adults on wait lists for home-delivered meals. Now, this is really unacceptable. Malnutrition leads to increased falls, serious illness, and hospitalizations. Together, we can prevent these consequences by ensuring that our priority population, low-income, and health-compromised seniors have the food that they need. In today's era of workforce shortages in hospitals and nursing homes, we really must invest in relatively simple, low-cost services that help older adults live at home. Now, home-delivered meals and group dining reach older adults who are food insecure, and they support those with health conditions who cannot shop for food or prepare meals. Last year in the metro, in the seven-county metro, 29% of home-delivered meal recipients were older adults of color, and 70% had incomes below 200% of poverty. Our providers offer culturally specific meals and offer meals that address health conditions like diabetes. Minnesota seniors don't ask for very much. They do without. I've observed this in more than 25 years of mission-driven service in aging services.
But I think that you'll see, as evidenced by the letters of support from AARP Minnesota and the Senior Caucus, that Minnesota seniors are asking the legislature to increase funding for meals. In your materials, there's an analysis of the senior meal program over the course of the pandemic. Demand rose, and with COVID-19 stimulus funds, we were able to serve 15,600 more seniors in 2020 compared to 2019. And the numbers of meals we were able to deliver rose by about 1 million in 2020 and again in 21. COVID-19 funds gave providers confidence that they could reach out and offer meals to older adults in need. However, we're exhausting our COVID-19 funds and can support far fewer meals in 23. We project fewer yet in 25. Inflation has increased the cost of food and delivery by 26% from 2020 to 22, and of course will have impact going forward. By 2025, our capacity to serve seniors will be skeletal while the older population continues to grow. The evidence is clear. Increasing state funding for meals will yield better nutrition and reduced isolation for our state's most vulnerable, low-income, and frail seniors. It will support them to help them live at home and be able to meet more of their basic needs for medication, housing, and utilities, and result in fewer hospitalizations and premature nursing home placements. People of all ages need adequate, healthy food. Please increase funding for meals for our older neighbors throughout Minnesota. We cannot forget this population and their needs as we address food insecurity in our state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Minnesota seniors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Simonson. And next, I believe we have Roxanne Jenkins on the list. And I know we are running a little short on time. We may be able to go over a few minutes, but I do want to make sure we keep testimony concise. Please come down. And Lee Herbert, please be ready to testify as well. Thank you. Ms. Jenkins, if you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Bonner, members of the committee, my name is Roxanne Jenkins, and I'm the Associate Vice President of Older Adult Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2523. LSS has had over 50 years of experience serving as a respected, trustworthy meals provider, offering nutritious, well-balanced, affordable meals to older adults through congregate dining and home-delivered meals in 165 communities in 43 counties across the state. In 2022, LSS Meals provided over 1.5 million meals to older adults in rural communities, and we only see the need growing. More Minnesotans need access to Minnesota's Senior Nutrition Program. Our older adult population is growing, and so are the food insecurities that they are facing. Additionally, the cost of food and transportation for meals has drastically increased. In 2022, we saw our increases in food and supply costs grow by 15 to 22%. We too are experiencing those staffing shortages, often competing with manufacturing or other entities with higher wage offerings, making it necessary for us to increase our wages to keep pace and fill those necessary positions in our kitchens. LSS Meals primarily serves greater Minnesota, so serving from Halleck and Kitson County, Baudette and Lake of the Woods, to Walker and Cass County, and Laverne and Rock County, and numerous towns and townships between. Many of the communities we serve are what we call resource light. And sometimes LSS Meals program is the only resource around. It's an honor to serve and support our older adult neighbors. I've learned that many of you have stories or experiences directly with senior nutrition. I'm going to share mine. My first involvement with senior nutrition was when I was 14 and my mom had the brilliant idea of having me join her in delivering Meals on Wheels. To say it had an impact on me would be putting it mildly. I saw the experience firsthand, what a meal and that brief visit meant to every person that we delivered meals to. It's been a while since that day, but however, 28 years I've dedicated my career to serving and supporting older adults, and meals has been the cornerstone. It's been 20 years since we've had an increase in state funding for meals, and now is the time to make much needed investment. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jenkins. And Ms. Hebert? Go ahead and state your name and your affiliation, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. It's actually Leah Abair Wells. So, sorry. Okay. And I am the CEO of Open Arms of Minnesota. For more than 35 years, Open Arms has been preparing and delivering medically tailored meals to vulnerable, sick, and food insecure Minnesotans. With the help of thousands of volunteers, we make meals from scratch in two kitchens, one in South Minneapolis and now our new kitchen in St. Paul. We prepare 1.3 million meals a year, and we deliver and ship those meals to thousands of Minnesotans who are living with life-threatening and critical illnesses. Our clients typically live with cancer, MS, congestive heart failure, HIV, end-stage renal disease, and more. Often they are living with more than one illness. We provide meals for their caregivers and dependents as well. We deliver meals to their front door if they live in the Twin Cities, and we ship them their meals if they live in rural and outstate Minnesota. What makes us a little bit different is that we provide medically tailored meals that are tailored specifically for our clients' illnesses. For instance, a low-salt menu for someone with heart disease, a dialysis-friendly diet for our clients with kidney failure. We're the only ones in the state of Minnesota who are able to do that. More than two-thirds of our clients are over the age of 60, and more than 80% are living with food insecurity as well as a critical illness. And all of them depend on Open Arms because these people are unable to shop or cook for themselves. In the last 2 years, we've responded to a 40% increase in demand, and we know that's just the tip of the iceberg. We have been fortunate enough to receive state funding through our incredible relationship with Trellis, who you just heard from. And senior nutrition funds and other federal dollars have helped thousands of our clients over 60. But as you've also heard, it's critical that we continue to invest in nutrition for vulnerable older adults. You've heard from other people today that will tell you about the real need in the community. I would like you to hear from the older adults themselves in their own words. From Lauren, age 76, who has multiple sclerosis exacerbated by a stroke, she says, "If I wasn't receiving all of the healthy foods from Open Arms, I'm absolutely sure I would have to sell my home and move into a nursing home." From Anne with congestive heart failure and kidney disease, "I'm not spending my energy shopping and having to carry and load the bags into the car and then into the house. These meals help me keep out of assisted living." From Sue, "In just 4 minutes, we can have a meal ready. A good, healthy meal that leaves me more time with my husband. At this age, our time together is so meaningful. After 67 years together, Open Arms has given us more time together to eat healthy meals." Lastly, from Ed, "I feel blessed that we can be helped by Open Arms. Sometimes seniors can feel that because you're old, nobody cares. Open Arms sent us a message that yes, they do care and help us. Investing in senior nutrition helps reduce hospital visits and nursing home admissions. It saves money. It provides hope and comfort for a group of people who often feel forgotten. Senior nutrition helps people stay in their homes. It provides families more time together. And it is not overstating to tell you that senior nutrition truly does save lives. On behalf of all of our clients, I thank you for your time."
Thank you, Ms. Hebert-Wells. Just to be clear, is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify on the bill before we move to member discussion? Seeing none, we have Representative Baker on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Question, again, I think the need is real. I'm struggling with the four times the amount. I think that's a big increase with, again, understanding the workforce is different today. The cost of food is real. I get it. I'm in that world of that. But it just seems like we've got to be careful with what to ask for and how much, because there's other ways folks are getting these meals out there too, with other providers out there too. Again, I used to sit on some other nonprofits and do the Meals on Wheels in my area. And again, they get funding from different things, but I haven't heard that it's this much underfunded. So I'm not saying that it's not. I question why the number of this versus what was funded in the past.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. If you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Baker, thank you so much for the question. And I think where this comes real stark is in the stats that were provided to us. When the pandemic hit, it started showing what the real need was out there. There was a huge increase, and it was part of the information that was handed out is we saw how much was needed out there. And so what this need was, what they're basing it on is taking a look as those federal dollars go away, they need something to replace it to continue to meet the need that's out there and the fact that it's continued to grow. We know that the senior population is exploding and the people who want to stay in their homes is requiring more services, and we're seeing the pressure on the demand elsewhere. And when this was brought to me, they said, this is what we need to meet the demand is. They said, I told, don't shortcut it. You know, what is the real ask? And so this is what the real ask is. As we've heard before, the challenge is going to be we only have limited dollars. And so we want to make sure people understand what the need is. And then from there, leave it up to Chair Noor to make the difficult decisions for what's going to get funded and at what rate.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Celestnikar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Fisher. I wonder if it's possible that some of the data could look different, because in the COVID years, many of the seniors were not accessing long-term care and assisted livings because we weren't doing admissions. And there was a real change in the typical pattern for some of these living settings. And I don't know that as a fact. I'm speculating that it could be possible. To Representative Baker's question, I think we need to be cautious on basing our assumptions based on the COVID period, because the way we operated was so different. And the nursing homes and the assisted livings and the independent living, when people can't be at home, many times it's because of other factors besides the nutritional needs for seniors. And so, but many of them were not accessing the proper level of care because we were in unprecedented times. They were choosing to stay home because they didn't want to be away from family members, because if they went into the facility, they couldn't see their family members. So I had many people refuse to be admitted because they didn't want to be away from their family. And families choosing to delay needed admissions because they didn't want family connections to be changed for them in these critical times. So that's a caution, I think, that we need to be aware of. But otherwise, I understand the importance of, you know, doing meals for seniors. So thank you.
Thank you. We do not have any further member discussion. So with that, Chair Fisher, if you would like to go ahead and renew your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2523 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. House File 2523 has been laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, having no further business, we are adjourned.